I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 197 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is the brilliant author and biographer who has deepened my understanding and appreciation of much essential music, Peter Guralnick. I was introduced to him through his books Lost Highway from 1979, which details the work of American roots musicians, and Sweet Soul Music from 1985. That one sent me down numerous rabbit holes as it chronicles the creation of 60s Southern soul music through the fusion of gospel and R&B.
We're having a party, dancing to the music.
Guralnick also has written excellent biographies of singer Sam Cooke and Sun Records founder Sam Phillips, but his towering achievement is his two-part biography of Elvis Presley, Last Train to Memphis from 1994 and Careless Love from 1999.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I
books took someone who basically defines the term iconic and made us feel his beating heart. After you read them, you can't look at or listen to Elvis in the same way. Guralnick's new book, The Colonel and the King, is a spin-off of sorts. The author developed a professional relationship with Colonel Tom Parker, Elvis's longtime manager, while researching Careless Love. Parker died in 1997, but left behind volumes of correspondences with agents, promoters, friends, colleagues, and his sole client, as well as Elvis's father, Vernon. Incorporating this wealth of new revealing material into his own reporting, Guralnick creates a portrait of this identity-changing Dutch immigrant that will surprise anyone who thinks of Colonel, not the Colonel, as someone who controlled and ripped off Elvis Presley. The truth is more complicated than that, as well as often moving and heartbreaking. I was excited to speak with Guralnick and was not disappointed, as you'll hear in this freewheeling conversation. We bat around theories about, among other things, the impact of Colonel's constant deal-making on Elvis's artistry. Was Colonel exploiting his client or doing what he had to do to keep the free-spending Elvis afloat?
Well, it's Saturday night and I just got paid. I fool about my money, don't want to try to save.
What roles did each of their addictions play in their professional relationship? Does Guralnick view The Colonel and the King as a corrective to Baz Luhrmann's biopic Elvis, in which Tom Hanks plays the manager as a seemingly constipated, all-controlling villain? Has the author even seen this movie? Guralnick's expertise and enthusiasm on these topics is unrivaled. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Peter Guralnick.
Though it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers.
Your stuff is very readable and just makes me sort of see the stuff in a new light. And I remember in the Elvis books, and it's interesting to sort of see it. It's almost like a Rashomon thing with coming back to it from the Colonel's point of view. Because I remember experiencing like Elvis's mother's death from his point of view. And it was just such an amazing kind of portrait of grief and sorrow. And then sort of seeing it from you know, Colonel's point of view, where he's kind of like, he's sort of drifting a little bit and getting involved in other things. How is it for you to just sort of come back to a lot of material that you've covered, but just sort of look at it from this other point of view?
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's looking at it from a completely different point of view. And it's looking at it, in a sense, from the other side of the mirror. And so to me, it's all fresh. And a lot of it is stuff I didn't know before. It's not trying to change the story. Anybody who knows Elvis's story will recognize the events. But let's say you mentioned Elvis's mother's funeral. I mean, the emotional part is when Sam Phillips draws Elvis away from the body, or Elvis is just absolute grief. I mean, is at the funeral. Colonel's very small role. I mean, not that he didn't feel it, or but was basically organizing the funeral. And so there's very little about it from the standpoint of Elvis, and there's really very little about it from the standpoint of Colonel, because that isn't a key event in his life. But one of the ways it's reflected in the story of Colonel is when Elvis dies and Colonel returns to Memphis in total shock. I mean, just attempting to tell everyone, we are still representing Elvis. I don't want to see a tear. This is not a normal reaction, but he's in shock and he's devastated when he's told by Vernon that Vernon has organized a funeral, that he doesn't need Colonel's help, because that right. is the way in which Colonel contributes. That's the way in which he contributes, and his real emotional, I mean, in other words, he doesn't express emotions, but he reacts to emotions and he feels them.
Colonel, but actually, I'll just back you up on this, because we're talking about Colonel, and a lot of us thought of him as the Colonel. At what point did you shift and realize it's Colonel and not the Colonel? And sometimes it's both.
Yeah, well, you know, there's no hard and fast rule. I mean, it was just a funny kind of a thing, is that when I began corresponding with him, I guess to some extent when I would talk to people, Colonel's oldest friends, people like Julian Averbeck, or Abe Lastfogel, whom I didn't know, but Julian Averbeck, I did a number of them. You know, he was Tom. He remained Tom to them. And he goes back and forth in his, I don't know if you call them sign-offs. They're not salutations, but in his sign-offs. But when I realized that he was definitely Colonel is when I began my correspondence, or he began our correspondence in 1988. And he would sign the letters, your friend, Colonel, signed. And then underneath typed in capital letters, the Colonel. So I took it that his first name had become Colonel, as it had once been Tom, and before that, Andreas or Dries when he was in Holland.
Right.
And it just, in talking with friends, I mean, because I know a lot of people who were friendly with him, worked for him, and they all refer to him as Colonel. So I had a problem in terms of the book. How do I refer to him? And it switched. I mean, as you may have noticed, and he was Dries in Holland. He was Tom or Tommy when he was with the carnivals. He was Tom. And then eventually, really not until he started managing Elvis, did he become Colonel.
Yeah, it's this American dream story of someone constantly reinventing himself and sort of raising, adding this kind of loftiness with, you know, adding, you know, calling himself Colonel.
Well, the question is it loftiness or is it irony? Because
it sounds like both, I think.
Yeah, it does sound like both. And he always referred to himself as a phony colonel. He, in one letter, he says, have you ever heard of a phony colonel who had a horse named after him? And, you know, that was one, he had a horse named after him. But at the same time, while to him it was a joke, on the other hand, imposing the, the dignity, or dignity is the wrong word, of the title upon everybody who worked for Eddie Arnold, not on Eddie Arnold, who always referred to him as Tom, but everybody who worked for Eddie Arnold. This was in the early 50s, and forcing them to call him Colonel. Who knows what that means exactly? Some of them he was quite close to. Some of them he wasn't at all. I mean, they were just adjuncts. So I can't fully interpret it. I mean, the one thing that I do know is that for Colonel, irony was a fact of life.
Did he ever welcome you into the Snowman Club, or was that too far in the past by that point?
You know, I'd like to think it was too far in the past. On the other hand, I'm devastated that he... I have friends, I mean, Greg Geller, Andrew Salt, they've proudly shown their, you know, their Snowman's League badges and, you know, paraphernalia. Now, that was a little earlier, so I don't know, but who knows? I don't know, you know, you establish certain terms and relationships. And I, you know, I'd like to give myself a little dignity here. And I like to think that I just established a relationship in which it would have been inappropriate to induct me, much as I would have loved it. I mean, I would have been so thrilled, but whatever the case, I wasn't inducted.
He put you on the list.
He absolutely put me on the list. I mean, he really enabled me in so many ways to gain access to people that who were behind the scenes. This is when I was writing Careless Love, the second volume of the Elvis biography. And by inviting me to his 80th birthday party in Las Vegas in 1989, June of 89, when I went to thank him at the end of the evening, and he and Sam Phillips, who had never liked each other, but who I think gained respect for each other for the first time. It was probably the first time they had ever had an extended conversation. And they were arguing vociferously about all the events that had taken place in November of 55, when Colonel basically arranged for Sam to sell Elvis's contract to RCA. I mean, it was entirely Colonel's doing. And they were arguing point by point, month by month, week by week, minute by minute. And I'm standing there in the shadows. I've got a picture with Sally Wilburn, who lived with Sam and was his assistant, and she took it. And I love this, the author standing in the shadows. But anyway, I emerged from the shadows and to thank Colonel. And I said, I introduced myself. I said, I'm Peter Guralnick, and thanks so much. And he looked at me, maybe a little balefully. I don't know. We'd been corresponding for quite some time, and we'd met before, but only in passing. And he looks at me, maybe a little balefully, maybe just realistically. And he says, I put you on the list. And he had sort of a guttural voice. And his voice, as he grew older, grew more guttural. There was no accent, but other than his R's became W's to some extent. But anyway, so he said, and I said, oh, yeah, okay. He didn't hear me well. He didn't hear me the first time. And I thanked him again. He says, I put you on the list. And the third time he said it, all of a sudden, the light dawned.
Right.
And I realized he had put me on a list. And all these people I had met there, behind-the-scenes people, who I think otherwise would never... I wrote to them all afterwards. I didn't approach them. I mean, I might have shaken hands with them, but I wasn't going to say, hey, I'm working on a biography. Could you help me out? I mean, that's pretty ill-bred. So I... but I wrote to them all afterwards, and I am convinced that had I not been able to say I met you at Colonel's 80th, the majority of them would never have responded. But the majority of them did respond, and I got to interview almost all of them.
Yeah, I'm sure you've been to concerts where someone says, oh, I put you on the list, you're on the guest list, this sort of thing. and yeah, because I love that anecdote in the book. Because it's like he's sort of like making a point of letting you know, like, I bestowed this bigger thing on you. It's not just like I let you into this party. It's like you're on the list and you get to do your book because you're in the fold. And
I kind of, but I wouldn't go that far. I mean, there was much more subtlety to Colonel.
Right.
And one of the most touching things he ever said to me, both said it to me and he wrote it to me at least a couple of times, is, I want to be your friend, but I'm not going to be your patsy. And I felt like that exemplified so much. And I believe that, I'm not claiming any great intimacy. I wish I could, like I say, I'd like to be a snowman and I'd like to claim it, but I'm not. I mean, there are some people I've known very well, and I wouldn't say the Colonel was one of them. But the friend thing was good, but he was not going to be my patsy. But then, you see, when he was giving me advice about how I should promote Last Train to Memphis when it came out, and he said, he complimented me on it. He had one reservation, which was kind of funny because it wasn't in the book. But anyway, he was telling me the bookstores I should do, how I should arrange the TV experiences. And again, he told me, that I just shouldn't be their patsy. I should essentially look out for myself. And I thought that, that really expressed a lot of his philosophy, an element of his philosophy of life. He was not a trustful person. And yet when he gave himself to you, he gave himself wholeheartedly.
What was the one objection he had that wasn't even in the book?
The one objection he had, which must have been on his mind, was the idea that he had, that Elvis had split his income 50-50 with Colonel, which wasn't at all true. I mean, he had taken a 25% commission until 67. I mean, it's a relatively complicated thing. And I don't know
right.
If you
which you explain pretty, which you explain very well in the book, but.
Man, I've become such a student of finance and the music business, things that really, both because of Sam Cooke and because of Elvis. I mean, I have studied these documents and I'm not the most adept student, but I've studied them and tried to understand them and tried to explain them. But in any case, that was not in the book. And the interesting thing about his 25%, particularly for the first 10 years, was his business interests, Colonel's business interests, were entirely separate from Elvis's. So if the movie studio, for example, was paying $100,000 to Elvis, I mean, that was his salary, they would send a check for $75,000 to Elvis. It would go to Colonel's office because he did all the bookkeeping and he was meticulous in his bookkeeping. But it was $75,000 check for Elvis, $25,000 for the Colonel. And see, I said the Colonel. You can see how.
I mean, the title of the book is The Colonel and the King. So
exactly. But I wanted to call it How Much Does It Cost If It's Free? But nobody would go along with that. That was Colonel's title for his.
Right.
Never written on it. But the point was that out of the Colonel's 25% commission, the $25,000, he made a lot of money. he paid all of his expenses. So he paid for advertising. He paid for that, came out of his commission. So it was 25% was not an unusual amount. His mentor, Joe Frank, in the 30s, sounds like a wonderful guy who had discovered Gene Autry and managed Ernest Tubb, and Pee Wee King was his son-in-law. I mean, all big stars. But he took 25%. In Colonel's case, taking 25% meant it was not just a managerial fee. He did all the advertising. He did all the promotion. He was at every concert. He sold the memorabilia, not the memorabilia, the whatever you call it. He's
going to cities in advance and papering the place with flyers before Elvis even gets there.
But I mean, in other words, he was not simply a one artist manager, which is unusual enough. He was a one man operation who incorporated all of the roles that you would pay for. There was no big advertising agency. There were no legal costs. The legal costs were basically absorbed by William Morris and Hill and Range, who had the best lawyers. So he was delivering an all-in-one service, not just managerial service for 25%. So it was a pretty good deal, although it changed. It did change ultimately in 1973 to a 50-50 operation.
Have there been a lot of managers who were just devoted to one client the way Colonel was to Elvis?
Not a lot. I mean, there have been, for instance, Patti Page, who was a very big star in the early 50s and continued to be a star. She split her all income 50-50 with her manager, Jack, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Real or Rail, who became her husband and maybe stopped being her husband. I'm not sure about that, but the deal was a managerial deal. And Kate Smith also had a 50-50 deal with her manager. I don't remember whether she was married to him or not, but it was unusual. And the one artist manager was very unusual. And it was something the Colonel insisted was the reason that he could devote himself so exclusively to, and he didn't ever refer to Elvis as his client, to his artist's interests. Everything was about his artist and everything was about furthering his artist's interests.
Right. Yeah. Because I was trying to think of like more modern, versions of the Colonel. I mean, obviously no one's the Colonel, but I mean, I don't know whether John Landau with Springsteen, does that count?
I would imagine. I mean, and John Landau never set out to be a manager. I don't know. John Landau occupies many roles with respect to Bruce. The thing that's similar is his devotion to the artist. The thing that's different is that he has he is interested in many of the same intellectual and creative, elements that his artist is.
Right. He's been in the studio with him and produced.
He's been in the studio with him. Yeah, no, he's produced him, neither of which Colonel ever did.
Right.
Had nothing, but also he's been involved in exploration of literature or of film or of, in a way that is paralleled Bruce's interest in those areas. So I'd say it's a good parallel to Colonel with definite differences, but the dedication to the single artist, I think, is very much the same.
One way that I read this book, and you could tell me whether you feel this way or not, was as sort of a cautionary tale of kind of emphasizing the deal all the time. And obviously, that was what Colonel's job was making deals. And you do a great job, again, of breaking them down and explaining them so someone who's not that well-versed in finance can make sense out of it, because they're pretty complex things. But it's almost like for someone who, grew up, looking back on, the Beatles and their evolution and, all these other bands from the 60s and 70s and, like later 70s and 80s when I was like more, stuff was new to me. I think of like artists evolving, and there were so many deals that were locking in Elvis to do these movies and albums and everything else but at the same time, he was not involving himself in Elvis's artistic choices. But I just kind of wondered whether there was kind of a treadmill being created where somehow this, all these deals stifled him in evolving with the times when all these other bands and artists were sort of changing their sound like every year.
Well, I'm gonna disagree with that premise up to a point, but I'm gonna agree with you up to a point too. I think the real lesson of this, if you look at Sam Cooke's career, Sam Cooke was, I would say, a brilliant intellectual, along with, you know, having the kind of ability to communicate in the same way that Elvis could, in a direct, you know, direct communication to each listener, making each listener feel as if he was singing to him or her. But what Sam Cooke did all through his career was essentially to absorb everything he could from everybody with whom he dealt and then to move on. Alan Klein was his last manager. Alan Klein brought him both independence, respect, and a great deal of money. They were very close. Alan Klein worshipped Sam Cooke. But Alan Klein said to me he would have moved on, and he would have, because at some point he would have recognized the deal that he made with Alan Klein, which was unquestionably good when he made it, brought him just a great deal of money. I can't remember if it was $400,000, but just a lot of money that had never been seen by any R&B performer before. But he would recognize at some point, almost the way Mick Jagger came to recognize, also with Alan Klein, that he could make a deal like that on his own, or that perhaps he would prefer a better deal, or maybe that. And Alan recognized that, and he says that's the nature of things. But Elvis couldn't move on. I mean, Elvis, it's not that he was not cognizant of what the deals were. Colonel went over every deal in great detail with both him and Vernon. Elvis wasn't interested, but they heard and read and saw the details of every deal. But it would have been better, but he would have been better off, and probably Colonel would have been better off if after 10 years of a very good marriage, each of them had been prepared to leave. But you spoke about being locked into an artistic cycle. The movies you have to look at in a number of different ways, and we'd have to spend a few days here talking about it. And I'm not going to defend the 60s movies, but there's a lot going on there, including Elvis's clear desire to have as much money as possible, not in order to accumulate money. Neither he nor Colonel was the least bit interested in money. Neither one wanted to accumulate money or property. But Elvis loved to spend money, and he always right. He spent a great deal more money than he earned. So if he earned $2 million in 1964, which was would be $20 million today, he spent $3 million, and he was in constant financial trouble, and that became Colonel's function as a manager, was to bail him out, which is clear from the letters that Elvis's father, Vernon, who was the only other person in the room, those are the only three people who knew what the deals were. But Vernon wrote to Colonel, I mean, there's just a passel of letters in which Vernon is pleading with Colonel
right. To
bail him out. Now, let's get back to the artistic. So this is where I'm going to disagree with you. Elvis was, we know he was an autodidact, but he knew more about music and every different type of music than any PhD student of music, any ethnomusicologist might know, or as much as, let's say. And what's extraordinary about Elvis's career, and this is something that the young me would really scoff at and would reject and would, you know, say to the old me, man, you're such a sellout. You know, how could you say these things? But Elvis developed to such an extraordinary extent. So you look at his career up until he goes into the army. I mean, you know, you can't criticize it. You can't say
sure.
Anything.
Oh no, that's what Elvis. If he'd stopped there, he would be the legend Elvis Presley, absolutely. Like the way we look at it anyway.
And if he'd stopped after Sun, he would be too. I mean, so it developed the stages. But on July, I can't remember. It was the second 1956, right after the Steve Allen show. Elvis produced the session which produced Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel. He became the producer. Steve Scholes, who had been his A&R man at RCA, they really were not meant for each other. Steve Scholes was a great A&R man. Colonel had worked with him with Eddie Arnold, who had become a superstar in country under Colonel's guidance. They had done it together. And Steve Scholes was fine, but he was not right for Elvis. And with the Hound Dog, Don't Be Cruel session, Elvis took over completely, and Steve Scholes essentially just became the timekeeper. And Elvis insisted on, I can't remember if it was 32 takes for Hound Dog, long past the point that Steve Scholes would have given up to begin with and was satisfied, you know, midway through. He produced all his own sessions from that point on until the Chips Mullen sessions in Memphis at American Studios, which is phenomenal. But the point is, if you watch his development as an artist in 1960, when he returns from the army, 61, 62, 63, and which is, this is where the young me would just be yelling, what are you talking about, to the old me? It's the most extraordinary work, I think, of his career in many ways. And he becomes a song stylist, a song interpreter. It's just beautiful, beautiful songs. I mean, if I keep talking to Ernst Jorgensen, who puts out, you know, all the Elvis issues for Sony. And I said, why can't we just do a single album? He brought the idea up originally. And it would be the most beautiful album ever recorded. It would incorporate the best of the 1960, 61, 62, 63 years, where Elvis becomes a ballad singer. He becomes an aria singer. He does stuff like Reconsider Baby, or blues, or, you know, it's just a phenomenal range of work. And then, after really retreating from music to pursue his spiritual studies, which were a subject of great importance to him, and that's a whole other story. But then in 66, from the time he records How Great Thou Art, he enters into yet another phase of artistic development where he puts out How Great Thou Art. He in 66 and 67, he puts out three singles with Guitar Man and You Don't Know Me and U.S. Mail and Big Boss Man, kind of return to roots. 68, he does the television special. 69, he does the Memphis sessions.
Right.
At American with Chips Moman. And in 69, he opens in Las Vegas with really the most ambitious program. It's not to my taste exactly, but on Elvis's part, it's just the most ambitious thing of bringing together every strand of music that has influenced him with an orchestral backing. So, I mean, it's not like he didn't develop artistically, and he developed under his own steam, which was something Colonel from the start made it clear. He believed in his artist totally. He believed that Elvis was the greatest artist he had ever encountered, and that Elvis could make his own decisions, and Elvis knew his own business.
It's like he developed in this sort of bubble or just sort of alternative track to like kind of what was going on in the zeitgeist all the time. I mean, How Great Thou Art is a, you know, very accomplished record. It came out in 67 while, you know, Sgt. Pepper is out, and the Memphis in 69. I mean, it's a great record, and Suspicious Minds and In the Ghetto. I mean, those are considered classics. There's kind of this period in maybe the mid 60s, earlier 60s, where for me at least, like there are so many soundtrack records, and maybe it's because I'm sort of I came of age in the albums era. So when, you know, from Elvis in Memphis comes out, it's like his ninth studio record, and that's in 69, and he's been around for 13 years. So I don't know whether he was just in his own, doing his own thing, and really like not being affected by the other trends or anything, or
that's true to a large extent. I mean, you've got to exempt these soundtracks. They have nothing to do with his music. I mean, he does a good professional job, just as someone like Bing Crosby did a good professional job on his movie music. But the music that engages him, the music which he self-produces, the music which he chooses for himself, really stands outside of time, just as it did from the very beginning. So that How Great Thou Art, I mean, I actually like His Hand and Mine from 61, his first spiritual album. I like that better than How Great Thou Art, because his voice is just so beautiful and it's so simple. But How Great Thou Art is a great sort of bravura performance. But he's pursuing it. If you say Beatles, it's not that he's not listening to the Beatles. And I think you would probably be better at it than I. But you can find traces of the contemporary music in his music, which he incorporates. But for the most part, he's standing outside of fashion, outside of time. Recordings that I'm talking about in 60, 61, 62, 63, they're these beautiful ballads by, and not all, but, you know, Don Robertson, by Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann. There's a song in Viva Las Vegas, which, again, many people like Viva Las Vegas. I mean, it's their favorite film, but which is definitely an over-the-top kind of production, a movie. The song, I Need Somebody to Lean On, is the most subtle, beautiful ballad. I mean, I just think I would defy anyone to listen to it apart from all the other stuff and not be moved by it. And the scene in which it appears is almost like a scene from a Gene Kelly movie. Like, it's a dream sequence. It's right. Like from, you know, An American in Paris. And so all I'm saying is I'm not saying Elvis was infallible. I'm not saying he always made the right choices, but the choices were his own choices. And you can't think of the movie soundtracks as having anything to do with the music that he chose to develop and the ways in which he chose to develop it.
Right. It may be that he was just so committed to the movies and the soundtracks and everything that he was just maybe less prolific than he might have been if he was just making albums. I mean, like Dylan, Beatles, whoever, Stevie Wonder. I mean, they were spitting out like a couple albums a year, and Elvis, it seemed like there was just more time between the actual studio albums. Now, as you mentioned, he was also cutting singles like Guitar Man and stuff. But it just seems like the volume of it was lower, and maybe it's because he was extended to doing so many other things.
It wasn't an albums business. It was a singles business. Look at Sam Cooke. How many albums did he make? He made one album in his entire career. We made two. Nightbeat, which is a masterpiece. That was made as an album. And, I can't forget the first album he made after his association with Alan Klein for Tracy Limited. But it's not a very good album. I mean, it's not conceived as an album. I'm not saying
right.
the concept album was not a step forward for many people, and or maybe it was a step forward for the business, for the Beatles, but that was not the way anybody conceived of it. And Elvis was very prolific in terms of songs. The songs he produced in those 4 years of the early 60s, I think one of his greatest albums, if not his greatest, conceived of as an album, was Elvis's Back, which he recorded in several days following his release from the army. And it shows this extraordinary range. He comes home with this enormous ambition to express himself, and it's like Las Vegas. It just represents the full range of his musical interests and talents. And if you add in the singles, which never got included now, or rarely got included in albums in those days, it's one of the greatest albums of all time. But that's not the way they thought of things. And the albums became...
Yeah, it was more like a mid-60s and onward thing where it became more about the album. Like Rubber Soul and Blonde on Blonde forward, then that was more the way people sort of thought of stuff.
But you're also talking about singer-songwriters, and that was something that Elvis, I mean, in a sense, right. You have Dylan just producing this unbelievable profusion of words and albums, and it's like he's just on fire. And and as he says today, I could never write a song the way I wrote in Highway 61 Revisited, or Visions of Joanna or something.
Yeah, it's like he's looking back on it, going, "Whoa, wait a minute, what did I do?"
But that was not the way that I'd say Frank Sinatra probably was conceiving of albums. I don't know whether Only the Lonely was that what it's called, was conceived as an album. But his albums seemed to be thematic albums. Although again, he was not a writer. There were very few albums conceived as albums, not because Elvis wasn't capable of it, and not because the material didn't exist to do it. But that simply was not the thinking. Elvis's Back is one. From Elvis in Memphis, from the American Sessions in 16, that's 9 years later. How Great Thou Art is in the middle. And I don't know if you might be able to name one, but I can't think of another. But it's not because the material wasn't there. It's simply because that was not the thinking at the time. And right. I'm not the Colonel's thinking. It wasn't record companies thinking. And that was revolutionized by Dylan, the Beatles, Paul Simon.
And even by the 70s, when he's making, the album Moody Blue or whatever else, it's like it's still not like this. Here's, the latest Elvis statement of artistry or whatever. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, the new box set that's out, Hollywood Boulevard, and forget the box set. I mean, don't listen to me, Sony. Don't listen to me, Ernst. But the 1972 session from which it not primarily, but largely springs, is such a tale of woe. I can't remember what the original album was, but Elvis was so depressed. I mean, he suffered from what, we're not psychiatrists, you're not a psychiatrist, are you?
No.
No, me neither. Well, I mean, he suffered what could very well be called clinical depression. And he really never recovered from it, which is a tragedy in his life. And it's a tragedy that he couldn't seek help. And I mean, there's so many reasons that somebody in that position has difficulty saying, I need help. But in any case, but in 72, he was in the depths of depression. He was in the middle of the beginning of a separation from Priscilla. And every song, except for Burning Love, which he didn't want to record, is just a tale of woe and depression. I don't think it's fun to listen to, and I'm not sure that Elvis was at his best. Some people can really strike a spark from depression. I'm not sure that that was the case with Elvis, but that would be that would be a true album, but not of the caliber of what we're talking about.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's so many elements of Elvis's story that are just sad stories. But even in this, you know, from Colonel's point of view, when he's buying all the horses and creating the whole and building the stables and everything, and it's like, I'm happy at last. And you just think of the heights that he's reached, but he needs to buy horses to get happy at that point.
Well, and happy is, I'd say, a chemically assisted happy. And
right.
That exhilaration, what do you call it when you go from depression, from the depths of depression to the heights?
Yeah, a little manic at that point.
Yeah, and that's what happened. And then he crashes when he goes out to Hollywood for Clambake. Not a good goal, but he falls. And at that point, Colonel is able to regain control of the mechanics of his career, because things had really fallen apart at that point. I mean, and Colonel banishes Larry Geller, who was his primary spiritual advisor. And if I say that, I'm not putting down Larry Geller. I mean, Elvis sought out Larry Geller, who came in as a hairdresser, but who shared his spirit of spiritual inquiry and who had a great deal of knowledge. And that's what Elvis wanted. But during the time that Elvis was, let's say, I don't want to say under the spell of Larry Geller. I mean, he was pursuing his spiritual studies with Larry Geller as his mentor. But during that time, and this goes back to what we were talking about before, he never went in the studio to do anything other than a soundtrack album, because he had zero interest. This is from 2.5 years, from 64 to mid-66. And during that time, he never goes into the studio. I mean, this is a person for whom music has been the guiding and inspiring light for him ever since he was a small child. It's carried him through everything. He never goes in, and in the end, and this again is an interesting element of the relationship between Elvis and Colonel, is that Colonel is at his wit's end because Elvis has fallen down on all of his contractual commitments to RCA. And Colonel was a very straight-ahead businessman. You always live up to your commitments. You pay your bills on time. In fact, you pay your bills the minute they come in. You don't hold them for 30 days because the person has done the work and deserves to be paid. But Elvis had fallen way behind on his contractual commitments. So Colonel's solution to this was, in a sense, the same as his solution to many problems, which he couldn't address head-on from, an emotional is the wrong word, but in any case, his response to this was to make a deal. And the deal that he made for Elvis in 1965, at a time when Elvis's single sales had fallen by 40% since 1960, he made a deal in which for $2.1 million for Elvis for the next 7 years, but over the next 7 years. But he, at the center of that deal was that Elvis would make a gospel album for RCA. And at the center of Colonel's thinking was, this is the one thing that can motivate him. And so he brought the deal to Elvis. Elvis was delighted with the $2.1 million. That was fine. But he was also delighted, and it galvanized him, the prospect of making a gospel album. And he almost immediately began rehearsing with Red West and Charlie Hodge, who worked for him. And the ultimate result was How Great Thou Art. But it came out of a business deal, which is really an odd kind of thing.
Right. Well, and again, so much of this is driven by deals. And that's a case where Colonel indirectly, not even that indirectly, was actually getting involved on the artistic side because he was trying to get him back to making the albums that was, you know, that were, you know, required by the deals, and also using his own psychology to think, well, maybe this will get him back on track.
To get him to do what he loved most, and what Colonel loved him foremost. I mean, Colonel genuinely loved Elvis, and I think Elvis reciprocated. Elvis wrote to him when Colonel made the RCA deal, the deal that brought Elvis to RCA, "I love you like a father." That's both the most longest and most eloquent letter. It was a telegram that Elvis ever wrote. He may have written longer letters, but that was
right.
But it was a very, you look at the progress of their relationship over the years, and you look at something like in 1961, Elvis did a benefit for the USS Arizona, you know, which had been sunk at Pearl Harbor in Honolulu. I mean, did the benefit. And both Elvis and Colonel loved Hawaii. They both considered themselves patriotic, but the performance that Elvis gave at this benefit for the USS Arizona, even in the lowest of Phi, is just extraordinary and is galvanizing and galvanized the musicians. And Colonel could watch this and could see this is what he loves. This is what carries him away. This is what raises him to another level. And in the immediate aftermath of that, people say, well, Elvis didn't tour. Colonel kept him from touring. In the immediate aftermath of that, Colonel made a deal for Elvis to do a national tour with a sponsorship of RCA. And I'm not going to remember the right number of, you know, if it was 38 dates, you know, 42 dates. It, like all of Colonel's deals, it was capped at $1 million. It wasn't capped at $1 million. It reached a minimum of $1 million.
Right.
And that's what Elvis would have done in 62. But RCA backed out of much of it. And Colonel said, okay, if we can't do it right, we won't do it at all. And Elvis didn't tour again until didn't play live again until the 68 special, and then 69 in Las Vegas, and then he started touring in 70. But it was what gave Colonel the idea was what he saw was the performance that Elvis gave in Hawaii, and how that performance and being on stage lifted Elvis's spirits.
I do the chairs in your parlor seem empty and bare. Do you gaze at your bald head and wish you had hair? Is your heart filled with pain? Shall I come back?
You got to know Colonel while you were working on your other books. Then you got this treasure trove of letters, which is really an extraordinary resource and archive of just sort of showing you what Colonel, how he was dealing with, you know, making deals and what he was thinking and how he's communicating with people. And you set out to do this book, and you didn't set out to do this book as a corrective to other stuff, but certainly to flesh out the story, flesh out what people knew about it. You know, then something like Baz Luhrmann's Elvis comes out, and you have Tom Hanks playing the Colonel, and one scene he's reacting and seeing how, you know, excited all the girls are at him, but then the next scene he's telling them to tamp down, like, his sexuality. Don't be too found. And it was, to me, it was like sort of incoherent. Like, I didn't get it. And you know, and they used him as this framing device. I don't know whether when you saw that movie, it kind of drove you crazy, but it feels this book is like, you know, the tonic for that.
Yeah, I didn't see the movie for just this reason. But, and I'm, again, somewhat like Elvis. This is the only way in which I'm like Elvis. I want to do something that's outside of time, outside of custom, outside of fashion. It's just, I'm trying to present a portrait as best I can. But what you describe is the exact opposite of what Colonel did.
When everybody
else said, you've got to talk to your boy, and have him tamp down on the sexuality, he said, I'm not talking to him. This will resolve itself. He is doing what he wants to do. He knows what he wants to do. My artist knows his business. And that was exactly what happened. I mean, I call the early chapter on Elvis, one of the earliest chapters on Elvis in the book, because there's a whole story before Elvis, which if the story had ended before Elvis came into the picture, it still is an extraordinary story. But in this chapter, this early chapter about Elvis, I call it Defending Elvis, because Colonel is defending Elvis against every single entity against the record company, against the booking agency, William Morris, against television, against the movies. He's defending Elvis's choices, artistic choices, his ability to present himself as he chooses to. And this is an example of the mirror image, you know, which we were talking about earlier. I mean, everybody knows about Ed Sullivan. I'm not trying to tell a new story about Elvis's appearing on Ed Sullivan after Ed Sullivan said he would never have him. And incidentally, anybody who hasn't seen the Ed Sullivan documentary, I think it's on Netflix, should see it, because it's just, talk about this being a different view of Colonel. That's a very different view of Ed Sullivan introducing, rhythm and blues singers, people of color, into the mainstream in a way that nobody had before. It's an amazing documentary. So Ed Sullivan had, Steve Allen beats Ed Sullivan in the ratings. Everybody knows the story. Ed Sullivan says, okay, I'll have it. And he makes an offer of $50,000. So in the book, I've got the offer of $50,000 coming in through William Morris. And Colonel says, well, that's all very well. But Mr. Sullivan assured me that Elvis would have total artistic control. We need to have in the contract that, Elvis will have, artistic. He will have full choice of the songs he sings, the manner in which he presents them, the musicians who back him, and he will have total artistic control. And without that, without those elements, the $50,000 is meaningless. So I mean, that's the kind of thing. I'm not trying to say everybody should run out and say, "Oh, I got a scoop here!" You know, what a scoop. That's not the point. But the point is, my aim was to tell the story as truly, as truthfully, and as truly as I could. And not to be influenced by my own or anybody else's preconceptions, just to try where the story led me.
And you have not gone back and rewatched, or you have not gone back and watched the Baz Luhrmann Elvis movie?
No, I think it probably would upset me.
It would drive you crazy, I think. It drove me crazy, and I didn't even know all the stuff. I didn't know you were working on this book, but I was, because just internally, I was just like, this is so like inconsistent. I love Tom Hanks; he's great, but if not, it's Colonel Tom Parker. It just didn't make sense to me because, like scene to scene, I'm like, he's just kind of grimacing, like he's. I'm sorry to say this, but he's just sort of like seems like he's kind of constipated and uncomfortable or something. And it just, and I'm like, that's not my impression of what was going on. And it's like, if you're so drawn to how electric he is at the beginning, you're not going to be telling him to tamp down his electricity, you know, unplug.
But see, Colonel signed up Elvis within two weeks of having first heard him, within 3 weeks. He went to see him at the Hayride, and within maybe 10 days after that, he signed him up for a tour with Hank Snow, whom he was managing. One thing I wanted to mention with Hank, in the trailers that I've seen, the performer who does the Elvis, I mean, he's really exciting. I mean, the little that I've seen.
Austin Butler, he does a good job.
Yeah, Austin Butler. But the other thing is that there's Tom Hanks. If you would ask me who could play Colonel in a movie based on this book, I would say Tom Hanks could play it, but based on the real person rather than on a villainous, you know. But
that would be more interesting to have him play your version of Colonel.
But the point is, what the little that I saw in the trailer, he's got this accent, which is seems somewhere around, you know, a Yiddish accent. And it's like, he didn't have an accent. He lived for 50 years in this country without anyone ever suspecting that he was from anywhere other than from the South. Maybe they didn't believe that he was from Huntington, West Virginia, which he said he was, but nobody doubted that he was from the South. When Colonel first saw it, he was drawn to Elvis because he got a report that there was this kid in either Texas, I think it was in Texarkana, could have been New Boston, who had drawn over 800 people to a tiny schoolhouse show. So he was interested. So he goes to see him with his assistant, Tom Diskin, or his associate, Tom Diskin, at Louisiana Hayride. And it's not as if he became a devotee of rock and roll when he first saw him, but he was drawn to something. He was drawn to a quality that Elvis possessed that maybe was somewhat similar to a quality that Eddie Arnold possessed, which was a uniqueness. It was a difference from anybody else who was out there. He signs Elvis up within two weeks to go out on tour with Hank Snow starting in New Mexico. On that brief tour, Elvis is relatively unformed. He's unknown. He's untried. He's unproven. He's 20 years old. Colonel was sold from the first moment he saw him. it's not sold on the money. It's not sold on the commercial potential, although that always played into, you know, Colonel's thinking. He was sold on the ultimate potential of this artist as an artist, of his total difference. And I think what he saw, I don't think there's any question about that, because it occurs over and over again through the years, is Elvis's ability to evolve, Elvis's ability. Anybody can watch this evolution, not when Colonel first came in, but when Elvis was first signed with RCA. If you watch Elvis's performances on television from January 56 to January 57, you'll see an extraordinary change, because he absorbed everything. There was a learning curve that went beyond anything. And Colonel just saw him as of a different order than any other artist. And he writes in a number of the letters, "You are the greatest artist I have ever known." And Colonel's one article of belief was in the wonderful world of show business. You know, he didn't believe in organized religion. He didn't believe in anything else, but he believed in show business for what it brought to the audience, and also for what he felt was the honesty of acceptance. If you were not accepted within the realm of show business for a high birth, you know, for money, for anything but your integrity and your... But the point was that Elvis was the greatest artist he'd ever seen, and that's why he was so dedicated and devoted to him. He believed Elvis could overcome, live up to any challenge, and he believed that till the day Elvis died, sometimes to both of their disadvantage.
Well, and his instinct was dead on. I mean, if you're going to look at someone and say, "I've seen the future of rock and roll," at that point, or the future of music, or whatever else, I was sort of paraphrasing John Landau again. Yeah. But if you're gonna like bet on a horse, not that he's a horse, like Elvis Presley is like it. I mean, like you couldn't have picked a better artist to bet on at that point.
But there was nobody else prepared to make that bet.
Right.
Out to all of the. You know,
like in retrospect, it looks like obvious, but like, no, he's like, he knew when no one else did.
Well, yeah. And he went to these promoters, he went to these bookers, and, you know, everybody said to him, "Well, listen, come back in a couple of years. We'll see how this kid develops." You know, Colonel was at the top of the entertainment business. He was the most respected manager in the business. He had had the most success, and he was willing, ready within that 8 or 9 months that he first knew Elvis, to risk everything that he had for this untried, unproven artist, 20-year-old artist. And that's what he did. And it worked out, but it didn't necessarily have to.
One of the things I appreciated about this book is how upfront you are about saying what you know, but also what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And you'll sort of slip out and you'll break the fourth wall and you'll say, "Look, you know, we don't really know what happened with him and his father when he was in Holland."
Right.
And it's sort of a fascinating mystery. And obviously you reported this out and researched this out as much as you could. And there's something heartbreaking about when he's rejecting everyone in his family, when they're finally like figuring out who he is and where he is. And yet it's also something ultimately unknowable about like what happened there.
No, it's terrible. I mean, there had to have been some traumatic event that caused this sense of complete removal that he had, emotional and geographical too. And and we don't know what it was. I mean, he said a number of times to his widow, Loanne, who was such a big help to me in writing the book. I mean, that's how the book was transformed from a collection of letters to a collection of letters along with a biographical portrait. But he said to Loanne about his father, he was a bad, bad man. But if he said to Loanne how he was, I know, I mean, his father beat him. His father disapproved of him. His father had no sense of humor, where his mother came from a family of, they sold everything. They traversed the waterways of Holland. They were a much more imaginative family. But his father had no use for him at all. But that doesn't seem... He loved his mother dearly. He never came back to Holland. He broke off all contact. And as you described it, at the end of his life, and this really broke Loanne's heart, he would hear from members of his family, because by now he was recognized, he had acknowledged that he was Dutch, and he would hear from members of his family, and she would try to get him to respond, and he wouldn't. And what is it? You know, what did he have to lose? We don't know.
Yeah, his siblings he would turn on. And there was the one who it seemed like maybe took advantage of him and didn't share money that he was sending back. But that doesn't implicate the other ones necessarily. But he didn't want to have anything to do with any of them.
No, I don't think that really was a relevant thing. But the most revealing letter in some way, well, there are any number of revealing letters. Some of his letters to Elvis, which just profess, for somebody who has suppressed emotion to such an extent, some of the letters to Elvis in which he just expresses such indelible love.
Right.
In his own way, but it's there. It's just there. But one of the most revealing letters was when he writes back to the son of his brother. His brother was Art. Evidently in Dutch, he pronounced DT. I've learned this from my Dutch friends. So his brother was Art, and this was Art Jr., who was a student of languages, wrote to him in English to try to arrange for a visit. The family had recognized Colonel. They had no idea where he was. They saw a picture of him with Elvis when Elvis got out of the army. They said, oh, my God, he looks just like our brother who's a policeman. And that's our brother, Andreas, Colonel Tom Parker. So his nephew writes to Matt Jr., and he writes back, and it is most schizophrenic. I don't mean this is not, we don't need to be psychiatrists here. But it starts out in the third person as if he's some kind of remote employee of Colonel Parker, whom he rarely sees, but if he sees him, he'll
right.
Starts. And it ends up in this confessional mode in the first person. It's just and Art Jr. gave it to me, you know, and was a big help to me in terms of talking about the family.
Yeah, the shift in that letter is incredible.
Yeah, yeah. But all right, here's something to think about. The thing that is so extraordinary is in 1961, when Elvis's brother, when Colonel's brother Art came to visit him at Colonel's reluctant, very reluctant invitation, and they had it was a distant visit in which his brother spent most of his time sightseeing. And Colonel had one of the William Morris agents take him around. But at that time, and this is in the spring of 61, by the summer of 1961, everyone in Holland knew that Colonel Tom Parker was Dutch. But this was Andreas van Kirk. Nobody in America knew that Colonel Parker was Dutch, except for Elvis Presley, to whom he introduced his brother Art. How weird is that? And when you're talking about, oh, it must have been such a deep, dark secret, how many people can imagine a world like that in the world that we live in today?
Right.
Where, you know, an entire country knows that he's Dutch and nobody in this country does.
But there's so many aspects of this that couldn't have happened today. I mean, just the volume of letters and the letters themselves, you know, it's like when you, aside from the fact that it would be emails and you'd have to be, you know, like the archive would have to have a bunch of stuff from the sent, you know, the sent folder or something, like you couldn't have gotten this information now about someone because you wouldn't have those letters, and the letters themselves would have been composed differently, because something like that one where he starts off writing like he's, you know, his own assistant, and then by the end he's like, if this were to happen, and all of a sudden it's shifting, you probably, if you're writing an email, would maybe rewrite the top part of it. But if you've already committed yourself to ink on paper, you're just like, well, this is how it's coming out. So it's just a totally different thing.
Well, I mean, the point was his writing style, it's some sort of like this Kerouacian spontaneous Bob Prosy. He just wrote, it just came out spontaneously. And this is from a fifth grade Dutch elementary school dropout. And it's incredibly eloquent self-expression in some ways. But in other ways, I mean, it's completely unorthodox spelling. It's the syntax is Colonel's own. The punctuation is virtually non-existent.
He always leaves out the H in which.
He did, yeah. The first H in which.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, there are two H's, but yeah, the first H, W-I-C-H, is what he kept writing.
And you know, so I left all that. I explained in the introductions to some of the letters that he appears to be expressing himself with such rapidity, with such emotion, that there is literally no punctuation, and that I have put in an occasional period. I might even make a paragraph. I mean, but for the most part, they're exactly as he wrote them, and they're written utterly, altogether spontaneously, which means sometimes, and this is something where I used ellipses for That's a substitute for repetition, because sometimes if he wanted to teach you a lesson, to teach Elvis a lesson, or to be sure he had his attention, he might write the same directions two or three times, you know, in the same letter. And I didn't think the reader would have to be subject. I figured the reader could get it the first time around.
Las Vegas. Is Las Vegas kind of a villain in this story? It seems like that's where the downfall for both of them takes place.
Well, that's what I was telling you before, that, you know, to follow the story where it goes, that's not where I wanted it to go. I did not realize, and I'll tell you the difference, and somebody can check me out on this. And I'm not disowning what I've written before. But if you look at the portrait of Colonel that I drew in Careless Love, and the portrait of Colonel that I drew in Looking to Get Lost, which is about my relationship with the Colonel. I mean, not to blow it up that much, but it's just about this relationship I had with him. The picture that I draw of the Colonel, and it was just to the best of my understanding at that time, was of what Jack Soden, as the CEO at Graceland, calls a lovable rascal. And in that sense, he's a character in each of them. And in Careless Love, he's this Falstaffian character who kind of carries the narrative. But he is, in Jack's terms, a lovable rascal, a character who can rise above any circumstances. So that the Colonel that I portray, and again, I don't mean to disown this, I'm not saying it's, but this is how I saw it at the time. Colonel in Careless Love could lose $1 million, although I could only document $800,000 at the roulette table at a single time. And he could walk away from it just, you know, with feeling nothing. Now, in fact, I was right about one aspect of it. He didn't care one bit about losing the money. But what I came to realize, it wasn't me. I mean, I would never have written this on my own. You know, you can draw a lot of conclusions from the evidence, but I would never have drawn this. But this is something I got from his widow, Loanne, who loved him dearly. I mean, no wife could love her husband more. No spouse could love her spouse more. And she admired him as much as she loved him. And I can only imagine the pain it must have been to her to tell me some of the things she did. But she was committed to telling the truth. And she said, "Peter, I can't say it any other way. Colonel was an addict. He was a gambling addict." And at one point in their relationship, early on in their relationship, she says to him, "You care more about the gambling than you do about me." Now, I could never imagine him as a gambling addict, nor would I have ever gone out on a limb and said he was a gambling addict, because I thought, well, maybe he's a gambling addict. But she described, from her journals, from her diary, times when he would be, there were always times around the beginning or mostly the ending of a tour, on which everybody saw him in full command, which were clearly, Elvis tour in the 70s, clearly they were a tremendous strain on him. And she describes times when he would be in the casino for 3 days in a row without ever coming back to the room.
Right.
When he came back to their suite, at the end of 3 days, he was a wreck and he just went to bed for 2 days. But he was totally out of control. I had some of that information. I mean, I quote, his good friend Al Devoran, the voice of Elvis, has left the building. Somebody he knew back to 51 or 52. He's a great, great guy, Al Devoran. And Al described how Tom Diskin, his Colonel's closest associate, tried to approach him about his gambling. And Colonel just banished him from his sight. "Get out of my sight. I don't want to hear any more." And didn't talk to him for a good length of time. And when Al tried to say, Tommy, meaning Tom Diskin, "Tommy was just telling you that because he loves you," Colonel said, "Get out of my sight." And Freddie Beanstalk had told me the same thing. But I'm such a dummy, and none of that registered to the point, the point that I didn't have a context to see that until I spoke to Loanne. So you end up, as you said, with these two people, and none of this had manifested itself before Las Vegas. Colonel, he loved to gamble, but he never gambled to excess prior to that.
Right.
So, you know, you end up, and this was not the whole of the book, because there's so much joy in Colonel's life. There's so much, he's just a man in full. He's somebody who got so much out of life and it was so positive in so many ways. But you end up in Las Vegas with these two people. I mean, with Colonel, a gambling addict, Elvis addicted to, let's call it prescribed medications. And neither one of them able to confront the other, because each of them knew the other's secret. And if one should bring up the other's problem, hey, I'm screwing this up, but you know.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like, it's sort of like mutual. Yeah. Yeah. No, they're like enabling each other because they don't want to deal with their own addictions.
To a degree, to a considerable degree, Colonel made clear attempts to try to get Elvis back on the right path. He tried to get him off the road. There are several letters here where he suggests to Elvis, maybe I only had one, but there were several letters. He said suggests to Elvis that Elvis is not giving his all in performance in Las Vegas. He's letting his audience down, which he knows a great performer like Elvis would never want to do. He would never want his audience to think he was taken for granted. And while Colonel, this is Colonel's letter, you know, would never suggest what Elvis should do, you know, what new songs he should do. He knew that Elvis would know what to do. And he says, if you believed in yourself half as much as I believe in you, and I forget what the upshot of that is. I mean, you would be the greatest performer, but he says you are the greatest performer. So in small ways, he tried to intervene, but it was always from the side. It was never head on.
Well, and as you mentioned, there is that tail dog relationship where Elvis is spending so much money that he keeps needing more money, and the money's in Vegas. So he keeps it. So Colonel keeps making these deals to have him in Vegas.
Actually, the money wasn't in Vegas. It was on the road. So, I mean, Colonel discovered in 1971 with the first, I think it was extended tour that Elvis took.
Was that Jerry Weintraub when he was doing that?
Yeah, although I wouldn't say it was Jerry. It was Tom Hewlett, who was Jerry Weintraub's partner, who was really the only partner that Elvis took on, and who was a full partner in terms of doing the tour, who knew everything about touring. He and Colonel together knew more than everything about touring. But they went out on an eight-day tour. I think it was November of 71. And they came back from, I think I have a picture of the first date in Phoenix in the book, maybe. But they come back from that tour, and they have a $500,000 profit to split. Now, at that time, Colonel kept improving the deal in Vegas. But basically, Elvis was making $1 million for 8 weeks in Vegas, which is a great deal. I mean, that's a lot of money, but it wasn't all profit. They go out on tour for 8 days. They make $500,000 profit. You can see the temptation to keep expanding on the touring. But it was Elvis in the end who needed to tour because he needed the money.
Right.
And who was always pushing for it. So it's kind of the opposite. I mean, again, I'm not blaming people, and I'm not, you know, it's hard to see it the way it is if you don't have, you know, the facts. But it really was. Elvis was desperate for the money because you can't blame somebody. This is the way he chose to live his life. He was very generous towards other people. He was generous towards himself. I mean, Graceland took a great deal of money to keep going, but there was no question. I mean, there were points at which he was on the verge of, according to Vernon's letters, he was on the verge of losing Graceland. He was on, Vernon didn't know how they could pay the IRS, and he's telling Colonel, you've got to come up with a deal. And Colonel always did.
Right. So, okay. So here's the silly question. One of the perhaps the weirdest record in my collection is Having Fun with Elvis on Stage. Came out in 1974. And from what I understand, and you might know more about this, Colonel put this together as a way to sort of circumvent RCA's royalties because this would be a spoken word record. It's basically Elvis's banter between songs, and that's the entire record. And you just hear him asking for water a lot, and it's just a bizarre piece of work. So I'm just wondering, like, if you sort of in researching, you know, these books you've done, if you sort of come across anything that explains the existence of Having Fun with Elvis on Stage beyond what it is that I've seen.
I think you're right about it. It also was part of Colonel establishing Boxcar Enterprises as a way of once and for all establishing ownership of merchandising rights. Originally, in 1956, he had set up a deal with a guy named Hank, I'm going to forget his last name, who specialized in merchandising rights. And it was very profitable before Elvis went into the army. I mean, very profitable, and profitable for Elvis and for Colonel. But once they started going out again in the 70s, they were kind of operating in the same way that, you know, that he had in the 40s. I mean, when he sold merchandise for Eddie Arnold to audiences by going through the audience. And he and Al DeVore did a lot of the merchandising, but it wasn't well organized. And so what he did was he set up this Boxcar Enterprises, which would be, and I can't explain it. I've been through it many times. I've had it explained to me why it was good for everybody. He gave shares to Tom Diskin and to a number of different people. But it was his business. He was in charge of the merchandising business. And maybe he had 50% of it. The percentages kept changing. But I think and having fun with Elvis on stage, this was not the high point for either Colonel or Elvis. I can't.
Well, it just reflects so badly on him that you're just like, why would you put this out for your, you know, make your artist look like this? So, and yeah, I think it originally came out on this Boxcar label.
Yeah, it did.
And RCA stepped in and said, you know what? That's not a loophole. We have to put it out. And then RCA put it out. So,
but it made a good deal of money. But in some ways, I think if you were to say, I think it's the most stark example of why Colonel should never have made artistic choices.
There you go. Yeah,
but no, I mean, it's sort of indefensible, and it's hard to. I keep thinking, you know, because Colonel did give me advice about how to, you know, how to market. I think I told you this, you know, the Last Train when it came out. And I keep thinking that Colonel is speaking to me in the process of, you know, this book coming out. And, you know, you get some good notices, you get some bad notices. This is a whole different world now. There are very few book reviews left. The New York Times still has a book review, Washington Post Book World. Everybody has a separate publication. And most things are publicity or listicles. And I'm not complaining about this in any way. But so you get some good notices, you get some bad notices. But I picture Colonel telling me, he says, you know, you're getting an awful lot of free advertising here. How much did you have to pay for that free advertising? And as Colonel thought, whatever any notices at all were good notices. And I think that's almost the only healthy way to look at it. I'm not going to say that's what made, you know, having fun with Elvis on stage such a great thing. I was appalled by it at the time. And even my older self is at least equally appalled. But I think that represented it. Colonel sold, or so he said, you know, both I love Elvis and I hate Elvis buttons at Elvis's peak in 1966. Right. And from his point of view, it didn't make any difference. It got the name out there. So that's the only explanation.
It was product that he owned and thought he owned outright until RCA objected. But
I don't think that RCA took ownership. I think RCA wound up taking over distribution and paying far more than they would have. But you're right, far more than they would have had they put it out to begin with, which they never would.
Right, so, they would have been like, what is this? I'm not putting this, Elvis Asking for Water is like track two or whatever it is.
But I'm very sorry he did it.
If there are other book topics that are nagging at you now that you're looking into for your next book.
In my next book is going to be a collection of short stories. Published by Godin, who published Lost Highway in 1979 under different ownership. David Godin owned it. This is an independent publisher. It's a great independent publisher. David Godin owned it until recently, and it still bears his name. But this is a collection of short stories, which I've been writing over the last few years. I've never abandoned fiction. And the first two books that I did publish, they look like pamphlets, but they were collections of short stories that I published when I was 20, I think 23.
Nice.
And so this is that's the next book. And I have a number of other books in mind. But my aim is always to get through the next day, through this day anyway. But I'm excited about that because I've written 10 novels. I've gone back to the last novel I wrote, which and I left unfinished, and I'd like to finish that if I can. But I've never abandoned fiction. It's mostly what I've read over the years, and it's always been my inspiration. And one of the most thrilling things for me when I got to Last Train to Memphis. I mean, in all of it, this has been thrilling. I mean, to write about Muddy Waters, to write about Howlin' Wolf, to write about Solomon Burke, to write about Otis Redding, you know, it has all been to tell people from the very beginning when I started with the Boston Phoenix and Boston After Dark. It was thrilling just to be able to tell people about this music that I love so much. And as I found the profile form, you know, I found that to be the best way to communicate both my love and respect for both the music and the musicians. But when I was writing Last Train, and, you know, I could still consider myself a failed fiction writer. Well, you can still call me a failed fiction writer. Maybe
No.
No, you can.
If you've written like 10 novels, I would say you're a successful fiction writer. So,
I certainly found more success with the nonfiction. I published one and part of another of the novels. But as I was writing the Last Train, it suddenly came to me: this is like writing a novel. It's like writing a novel on a vast scope that none of my fiction novels. You know, achieve or rival. And it's writing with these great characters with their great ambitions and aspirations, people like Sam Phillips, but also people who are creating a music business out in Odessa, Texas, or, you know, and people of imagination, but like so many people I've written about, but little formal education. And I just felt like, wow, I've found this landscape. And it is like writing, you know, a novel. And I've come to think of that. I mean, you can't compromise the factual basis for it. You can't make up things. You can't. But I've always wanted to tell a story. And I've always wanted to tell a great story. I want to be true to the characters, the real life characters. And that's what each of the biographies has been for me. And so that was, you know, I sort of felt like that was a revelation to me, or a realization that gave me a great deal of satisfaction.
So when's this short story collection coming out?
About a year from now.
Do you have a title for it?
Yeah, but I'll tell you why I won't reveal it.
Okay.
When I came up with the title Last Train to Memphis, I told Sam Phillips. He became indignant. He said, "What the hell are you talking about? Last Train. There are going to be a lot more trains. You know, this isn't the last train. There are going to be any number of trains. Why'd you call it Last Train?" I told Colonel about it, and I knew them both at that point. He says, "I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, we took the train from sometimes, you know, but money doesn't grow on trees. We took buses, too." Since then, I decided I'm not going to reveal any more titles before their time is due.
There you go. Well, thank you so much. I've learned so much and gotten so much pleasure out of reading your writing over the years, decades really. So it's a pleasure to finally get to talk to you, fellow Boston Phoenix alum. And this book's great, and I really enjoyed it. And I can't wait to read your short stories. And you know, I think there are a couple of your books I have to go back and read, because I haven't read every single one. So, but everyone I've read has been excellent. So thank you so much.
Yeah, no, listen, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
That's all for episode 197 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Peter Guralnick for offering even more illumination into the lives and work of Colonel Tom Parker and his one client, Elvis Presley. The Colonel and the King is available now from Little Brown. And of course, if you haven't already read Last Train to Memphis and Careless Love, it's time. Other Guralnick books to explore include Looking to Get Lost, Adventures in Music and Writing, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, Searching for Robert Johnson, Sweet Soul Music, Lost Highway, and Feel Like Going Home. There's also a novel from 1980, Nighthawk Blues. You can find Guralnick on Instagram and Facebook. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who has never told me he wants a little less conversation. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.